Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with co-host Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo. We've got a lot to cover today, so let's get to the news. And heading off the news is something that's been developing over the past week. There is an international regulatory probe investigating alleged manipulation of LIBOR rates. Now, this has not gotten a lot of attention, but it is a very important thing, particularly for those of us who've been following not only what happened leading up to the financial crisis of 2008, but what could very well be happening this year, because the LIBOR rates directly impact adjustable rate mortgages of all kinds. They are the rates upon which those adjustable rate mortgages are based. And if LIBOR rates go up, adjustable rate mortgages go up, regardless of what's going on with the rest of the industry. So this is very critical stuff. The latest report that I'm drawing from here is a Reuters report that came out today. It appears that Barclays PLC is the main focus of the international probe. This, according to the Financial Times, reporting on Thursday, citing people familiar with the investigation. Both U.S. and British regulators are investigating whether banks understated LIBOR to reduce borrowing costs and downplay investor panic during the financial crisis. The regulators are investigating whether Barclays traders and its treasury operators improperly communicated, violating so-called Chinese wall rules to prevent sharing information between the bank's different units, the Financial Times reported Thursday. Barclays Treasury Unit helps to set the LIBOR rate. Now, they're not the only bank being investigated. According to various sources, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Deutsche Bank are all part of the investigation. Some of these names I drew from Bloomberg News. And then one of the things that really bugs me, at the end of the Reuters report, they have one last paragraph. It says about $350 trillion. Bear that number in mind, $350 trillion worth of financial products, that translates into loans like mortgages, globally reference LIBOR and lower levels for the rate could have robbed lenders and investors of a significant amount of interest income. Borrowers, on the other hand, would have benefited. Now, Jake, here's a little quiz for you. What's the one thing they didn't mention about what the impact of the LIBOR rate would be?
I'm not sure, Walt.
Can't guess what it is. Could it possibly be the fact that when the LIBOR rate was being held down, it was understating the fact that a financial crisis was already at hand? Think about that. The LIBOR rate was already rising in 2008, and this particular manipulation, if true, now, of course, it's alleged at this point, but if it's true, it means they were keeping a rate that was already high down. That means it should have been higher, which means it should have been an earlier signal of a financial crisis. Now, let's fast forward.
People would have been aware earlier?
They would have been aware earlier.
What exactly is the LIBOR rate?
The LIBOR rate is an interbank rate. It's the rate that big banks lend to each other at.
And they actually set this rate themselves.
It's set by a consortium of banks led by, as the article points out, Barclay Bank, which apparently was at the center of the manipulation scandal. Uh-huh. Now, fast forward 3 years. They're still investigating what happened with this 2008 scandal, which may or may not be a scandal, but it sure sounded like it because it's an international regulatory cooperation checking into it. How do we know it's not going on today? And, of course, the answer is we don't.
Or for the 3 years since.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So it's very possible that the LIBOR rates being reported today are artificially low, which means what we've been talking about all along here on the Freedom News Hour, the possibility of a second round of mortgage meltdown could be ready to happen anyway. Because remember, one of the main things that all the opponents of the idea of a second double dip, so to speak, one of their main pieces of ammunition is, well, the LIBOR rates are low, so it's not going to happen again.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, no, just for our audience, the LIBOR rate stands for the London Interbank Offered Rate, and it's really, as you were saying, Walt, the daily reference rate based on interest rates at which the banks borrow unsecured funds from other banks in London, wholesale money market at 11 o'clock in the morning London time. But as you've related in past weeks, the LIBOR rate is used in the U.S. mortgage industry as well as over into Europe. So a lot of the Western world is tied to that interest rate. And, you know, I it's kind of funny because, again, I never had any proof, and it's interesting that this investigation is coming up. But if the central banks are seeking to control the interest rates of their treasury markets as well as internally, for instance, the Fed funds rate, why wouldn't they be manipulating all other interest rates as well?
And, of course, they would be. And the LIBOR rate actually makes a tremendous amount of sense from a central banker's point of view in terms of what you'd want to manipulate if you wanted to keep everything looking hunky-dory, because the LIBOR rate doesn't just influence mortgage rates. It influences virtually every kind of lending on the planet. It has a direct tie in so many different kinds of lending contracts.
Do you think they would...
in the contract, we're going to follow the LIBOR rate in terms of determining what happens with the interest rate.
Do you think this is major. Would they pass on this depression of rates, or would they try to profit on the difference, you know, the demand for the money?
Well, they're probably going to try to profit on the difference, but that's really a minor piece of the overall puzzle. The major piece here is by keeping the rates artificially low, they don't have to make it look like more mortgages, more loans are in default.
Right. From a Reuters article on this subject, they stated that, quote, about $350 trillion worth of financial products globally reference the LIBOR.
That's right.
And the lower levels.
Imagine what that number is. Think about that, $350 trillion.
Yeah, so
that's
just
huge.
About everything. And, well, probably a lot of that is derivative contracts. But the lower levels for this rate could have robbed lenders and investors of significant amounts of interest income. Borrowers, on the other hand, would have benefited. So, for instance, I would say that, correct me if I'm wrong, Walt, but one of the people or one of the groups that might profit from this is the banks that also are investment bankers and trade stocks, like on Wall Street.
Of course, the whole thing is very highly interconnected.
Oh, yeah, and also J.P. Morgan Chase, Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, and Bank of America have been asked to make employees available, so it's not just the Barclays. UBS is also involved, so it's pretty much the huge international bankers.
That's right.
Their names just keep coming up.
But I think probably the most amazing part of this whole story, when you take all the factors into account, is how little attention it's getting from the media. Among other things, it tells me one of two things. It either tells me that the media is complicit, which I kind of doubt, or it tells me the media are relatively uneducated, and I suspect that's more of the truth. Because really the only people among the media who probably understand this stuff are the people who work at the business desks. I mean,
right.
Call me crazy. So anyway, that's the big thing going on today. But, of course, lots of stuff's going on both here and overseas. Jake, we're going to go to you first talking about what's going on with Libya and the cost of the Libyan invasion.
Right. Again, since we had our show last week, the United States and NATO forces have attacked Libya, launching on the first day alone 114 Tomahawk missiles. I believe the total is up to about 162, most of which have been fired by the United States. And it's very interesting because, you know, obviously where the dictator Gaddafi was starting to look as if he would run all over the rebels. And initially, they had stated that this no-fly zone would pretty much be sort of similar to the no-fly zone over Iraq during the 1990s, where they would endeavor to shoot down any planes that are up in the air, but would not really intercede on the ground. That has kind of been proven to be completely incorrect. Not only have anti-aircraft and missile launch sites been attacked, but Gaddafi's compound was bombed, as well as numerous tank vehicles in line. And, again, all Gaddafi forces, they're seeking to blatantly help out the rebels. And what's kind of interesting is, you know, this whole thing, whether Tunisia and Egypt, has kind of been taken as a, you know, a popular democracy uprising. But when you take a quick look, and I would reference the work by George Friedman out of Stratfor at stratfor.com, he points out that a lot of these, that the opposing rebel forces that are actually armed consist of the tribes that have opposed Gaddafi kind of in silence for quite some time and have kind of taken advantage of the recent political climate to try and take power from him. And obviously he retaliated quite violently against it. But in terms of the United States, which you can make an argument that none of this international assistance would be helping because almost They are at pains to make sure that they mention other nations being, are sending ships, and only the U.S. has sent half the ships, et cetera, et cetera. But really, it's very plain that the American taxpayer is paying for all this. And the Vice Admiral Bill Courtney held a Pentagon briefing today to state that the French jet had shot down a Libyan plane, so the French had done something. But he stated that a total of 350 aircraft were now involved in the operation in some way, about half of them American, and 38 ships were participating, 12 of them from the U.S. Of course, the major ships are U.S., and we're using a lot of our air bases in Italy. But he insisted that Libyan ground forces would continue to be attacked as long as they threaten the lives of civilians. So that's an interesting way to how to determine that. And, quote, our message to the regime troops is simple. Stop fighting. Stop obeying Gaddafi's orders, unquote. So it really kind of sounds as if they're after a regime change, and I'm sure that if you were in Libya right now, it would be very plain and apparent that that's actually what is going on. And in the United States, what we here have done is literally Barack Obama, who was not even in the country at the time, he was, I believe, in Brazil or Central America on a tour of those countries, just stated, you know, we are going to attack Libya. And really, without a declaration of war by Congress or a declaration of really any type so far, and he's really kind of like one jet was shot down and F-15, oh, sorry, was technical difficulties was the word, and that cost $30 million. And when you add up all the Tomahawk missiles, it's another $162 million, and that's before all the other war materials, such as the regular munitions bombs, which cost about $30,000 a piece, all the workers flying, and all the attention that's kind of... So I would say that probably north of $1 billion has already kind of been spent on this. And what's really hilarious is when you start looking at the spending cuts that they're doing in Congress, not only are they expanding the national debt every day by about 72... they're spending about $72 billion, but they're talking about cutting $6 billion. And it's just ridiculous that the levels of spending that they're talking about, they're not even in the same ballpark to make any type of impact whatsoever. But if you go back to 2007, whether you follow current Vice President Biden or the senator at the time, Barack Obama, what they stated was that in reference to Iran and, of course, the Republican George Bush was in office, that they would not allow George Bush to take up violence against Iran without a motion from Congress. So, and they stated that they've consulted with constitutional scholars, and this is really would be completely illegal. Vice President Biden famously threatened impeachment proceedings, even though he's a senator and impeachment hearings start in the House. Small details, but the whole thing is that they are really completely disregarding the comments that they made only, two or three years ago to use that to, in order to get elected.
Well, they've also completely switched sides. Now you hear the Republicans saying, oh, why are you going into this war? You know, you shouldn't be jumping into this war.
well actually, that's the interesting thing, because the Republicans aren't really sure what to say.
Yeah, they're not sure what to say.
Because they want to be there. But it's Obama who's doing it, and that's bad.
Yeah,
because
he's doing it, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
but on the other hand, they're bombing Muslims, which is good from their point of view, right?
Right.
I mean, the whole thing is just so screwed up. And then on top of that, you have Gaddafi who says he's safe because he's hiding in a tent in the desert. I love that one.
Is that what he said?
That's exactly what he said, yes.
Yeah, and they bombed his compound, they call it, where he was living, I assume, right? It was part of that.
Who knows
and they
where
say
he
we're
is.
we're not after Gaddafi.
But I think the one thing that you can say for sure is that all the news coming out of Libya is likely untrue. That's about the only thing you know for sure.
Well, what about this story? Did you guys see the story where the jet that crashed because of mechanical difficulties?
Yeah, that's what Jake
was talking
about.
Where the people came out of their houses and they brought them tea and presents. Did you hear that story?
I'm
not doubting this story.
I actually believe that that story was true, because the weapons officer of that F-15, $30 million F-15 that got shot down, or maybe had technical difficulties. Who knows?
Yeah, $30 million in technical difficulties.
Either one of them received, was taken care of, and by rebel armed forces and brought into the city. The other pilot to ejected was rescued by a helicopter with Marines on it. So we actually landed Marines at some point. And he was being also the people there were trying to take care of him. The Marines opened and fired and killed six Libyan civilians.
Oh, you're kidding.
Including a child. So obviously we don't know the whole deal. We do know just those basic raw facts.
Yeah, I didn't hear that at all in the story. I didn't hear that part.
It's unfortunately it's quite true. So, you know, it's kind of very hypocritical and that you know, we would say, "Oh, we're not going to kill any civilians." Where the fact of the matter is, all this bombing and stuff is bound to kill civilians.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah, that's obviously the most underreported fact about this war or civil war or whatever it is. That there are a lot of people dying, and there just isn't a whole lot of way to cover that, I suppose. But on the other hand, it's not coming out.
The same thing happened with the Iraq War. I mean, they still have no idea the civilians killed, and you hear all kinds of numbers anywhere from, you know, 10,000 to millions, and it's just, you know, it's
terrific.
It's terrific.
And meanwhile, Gene, of course, the allies who were involved in this at the UN's behest first thought they had Arab support, and then they didn't. And I know you have some details about that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, you know, the region, this is a region that's affected, and of course they're going to have differing opinions, and that's kind of how it is. But the bombing of Libya that began Saturday, it opened a floodgate of competing emotions across the Arab world. And this is written, this article is written by two Arabs and Arab reporters, which supports the Libyan rebels but is wary of more Western intervention. The Arabs are watching the attacks against Gaddafi's regime with a blend of relief for the help to the outgunned rebels, trepidation about the ulterior motives of Western intervention, and envy in countries that have had problems where they called for international help and nobody listened to them. The Arab League initially supported the campaign, but its Secretary General, Omar Mouassa, said it had endorsed a no-fly zone. This is what you talked about, Jake, and not bombings. The confusion over what a no-fly zone entails persisted among ordinary Arabs, too, as Libyan state television reported at least 48 civilian casualties, a figure that couldn't be independently verified. This is a quote. My whole generation grew up with Desert Fox in 98, all the way up to the Iraq War, and then the Israeli occupation as well. So that tends to feed into a desire not to see Western political or military intervention, said Hiba Maraf of the Cairo Office of Human Rights Watch. In the case of Libya, however, it's more complicated. President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, another pariah state, is a lone voice in support of Gaddafi, perhaps fearful of similar uprising at home. Few others in the region would miss Gaddafi, who appeared to take delight in berating and goading fellow leaders. He's known for that. Let's see. And then usually Arab rulers tolerate each other no matter how idiotic they are in order to survive, said Mohammed Khatani, a Saudi human rights activist. But the guy is insane. There's no question about it. He's unacceptable in every way.
Well, and there's certainly a lot of doubt about Gaddafi's sanity, and included in that is the fact that he has often referred to what he claims to be the real cause of the whole conflict, which he says is led by al-Qaeda.
Yeah,
Jake, I mean, what do we really know about what's going on with terrorism in Libya?
Right, well, that was, you know, something that Gaddafi had, and really the rebel side both, during the early rounds of this war, was just a whole bunch of public relations stunts, because the rebels at some point appear to have taken Gaddafi's forces kind of a little bit by surprise. They had a lot of fairly, you know, relatively easy victories and were controlling cities at least for a little while before they got beaten back. But what's very interesting about Gaddafi and his history with terrorism is a lot of people, again, haven't studied history too much, and during the 1980s, Libya used Gaddafi specifically. He's been in power for about 40 years. He used a lot of terrorism tactics to attack U.S. embassies and any other of his enemies abroad. And he would a lot of times try to cover over it by having some Marxist brigade or some Islamic brigade take responsibility for it. But one of the things is, you know, with his back to the wall, One of the other concerns voiced by Stratford and probably some other places is that this may result in, you know, we talk about a war on terror, but he obviously wasn't a threat to the United States beforehand. But now that our country has directly attacked him, the same thing with Britain and France, one has to wonder if he will retaliate really by using a terrorist attack. And
yeah,
obviously, if that does happen and it is tied back to him, it could easily backfire and we'll send in the Marines. But very similar to what we talked about a few weeks ago to the European court, international court, threatening to bring him in as a war criminal if he was removed from power and immediately charge him. If he sees himself as nothing to lose, certainly he may be doing some very unpredictable things. And I just think that that's something that our U.S. International relations and diplomats really haven't taken a very close look at all. And
yeah, if he survives in power, he'll become a real threat. Wasn't it didn't President Clinton order a bombing of Libya? Is that true?
Just about every president ordered bombings of,
really?
Of Libya at some point or another. Maybe some of them may not have been publicized, but I would say that overall, we similar to al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden's attacks and the U.S. embassies, we didn't really do direct retaliations like perhaps we could have at that time. And again, what he tried to do, for instance, after the Pan Am bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland, that was kind of tied back to him more or less just because the airplane, there were some parts that fell onto land into the ocean. A lot of people have written that if the airplane fell into the ocean, which apparently was the plan, there would have been no way to trace it back. But they were able to trace it back and tie that to Gaddafi. And that's, you know, some of the past history. Like, this guy already has a history of using these tactics to get what he wants. And when you study terrorism, the other thing is it's always a tactic taken by someone that's extremely weak as opposed to the other side. Like, for instance, in World War II, there was very little terrorism going on because most sides were fairly evenly matched for most of the war. This is kind of a desperate attack given, but it could easily see that. And obviously, if Gaddafi remains in power, it's going to be very interesting to see what he does with the oil. I don't see him selling it to any of the countries that he went to war against.
Yeah, good point.
And that's one of the other things too, because Iraq was most likely at least somewhat tied to the whole oil thing, but in Libya, the United States consumer would have had access to the oil regardless of who won the fight, whether it was the rebels or Gaddafi. But now at this point, we've just further destabilize a region that is very quickly kind of spiraling out of control. I mean, you had bus bombings in Jerusalem yesterday. There's reports of Kenyan forces making a land invasion, a temporary incursion into Somalia, which has kind of been taken over by some brigands as well. You have riots in Syria, where I believe protesters were shot. The government just came out and said, we're going to make some reforms and give you guys some money. You had what we talked about last week, with Bahrain now under the country of Bahrain now under military occupation by Saudi Arabia. So it's just, you know, the Middle East is already a powder keg, and I just fail to see how the actions that NATO is taking in the United States really are mature even in the least bit.
Brigands, you don't hear that term very often. Is that another word for politicians?
Well, yeah, that could also be used for that. But now in Somalia, they have a government which Kenya does support, but it's very, very weak. And a lot of the other, obviously people are probably familiar with the pirates doing raids, but a lot of the other of the country is controlled by Islamic brigands. I mean, they follow no connection to al-Qaeda, but they follow the religion, and they're just against the government.
Well, as all this terribly good fun is happening on the Middle East, of course, Japan is dealing with their own crisis coming out of the earthquake, the tsunami, and the nuclear power crisis. And have you guys heard what's been going on with the nuclear power plant in Japan?
Well, I hear that they got power back, and a couple workers stepped in some radioactive water and were hospitalized with significant levels of radiation, but
That's right, and all that is true. But had you heard that all the reactors are now shut down?
Oh, every single one in the entire island of Japan.
Every single one shut
down.
Oh,
you're kidding.
Yeah.
They shut down all the reactors.
Yeah, and
which is like
you would think that would be an important piece of news, but of course it doesn't scare people. So it doesn't make it into the headlines.
There's like 130, isn't there, 134 or something?
And more critically, the six at the main power plant, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, those are all shut down. And basically what they're still doing now is making sure everything continues to stay cool, bring everything down to the cold shutdown state and all that kind of thing. But basically, the worst part of the crisis is over, and you wouldn't know it from hearing the news media. Figure that one out.
Yeah, no.
Why was that just a safety precaution to shut down all their nuclear plants?
Well, it's part of what they go through whenever they have a crisis like this. They shut the whole thing down so they can contain any problems with radiation and so forth, stop the threat of nuclear meltdown, you know, the whole nine yards.
Talking about the plants that were the six plants that were affected.
Well, I'm talking particularly about those. I mean, they've been shutting down other plants too, but particularly those plants have been shut down.
Right.
Well,
I guess so.
I guess we can't say that they're completely under control, but they're darn close. And a week ago, at our last show a week ago, we were talking at a time where the news media were basically saying, my God, a couple of these reactors are there's a very good chance they're going to run away into a meltdown. And it didn't happen.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were referring to every single nuclear power plant.
No, because they depend so much on nuclear power for electricity.
Well, there's a certain I think they have six reactors at the site, but
right.
I think three were running in the first place. I mean,
that's right. They were already in and out of state due to a regular inspection that was going on at the time. But the other three were the ones that were particular risk, especially unit number three. That was the one that everybody was afraid was going to go into meltdown, and they're not in that state anymore. I'm just pointing out, despite all the horrible news that's coming out of there, we really should be acknowledging that the Japanese are winning the battle.
Well, it's a sensationalism thing with the media. I mean, if it's not sensational, they don't really want to report it.
Exactly.
I mean, if it does get into control and everything's okay, I mean, they'll drop that story like a lead balloon, you know, because there's nothing to talk about anymore.
Well, they're hoping for a lead balloon because that blocks radiation. But
yeah, that's what they need, a big lead balloon surrounding the plant.
Oh, good grief. Well, obviously we're going to be hearing a lot of very difficult times coming out of Japan because the rebuilding of Japan is going to be horrific. In fact, the estimates came out this week that the total tab for rebuilding Japan so far estimated is going to be likely in the range of $300 billion, which is, of course, a gigantic amount of money. Although when you measure it in trillions, it's not a huge amount, but by normal human standards, it is a very large amount of money. So this is going to have tremendous impact on the financial markets, and we will have to talk about that, I guess, after the break, because we're coming up toward the end of the first half hour here. After the break, we're going to talk about not only what's going on with the financial markets, what's going on with silver manipulation, but we also have some more stories about what's going on with electric vehicle history and price of gas and so forth. Gene's got some interesting details about that. Plus, Jake has more information about what's going on with UK inflation and what's happening with the new home sales dives and a bunch of other things. Oh, and by the way, we have an interesting report about a guy who tried to coin gold and silver money, and he got arrested and convicted, get this, of counterfeiting. So stay tuned. We'll pick it up after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency, connecting people, ideas, important information, nurturing human renaissance, seeking to transform disintegrating empire into healthy, problem-solving, creative, evolutionary, peaceful communities. To hear us, listen every Thursdays, 5 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
South of border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
I'm Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Radio Network celebrating 5 years of independent news.
We all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know,
we're back here on the Freedom News Hour. And we're going to, before we get into the headlines, I want to touch on a guest that's coming to join us in, not next week, but the week afterward. And Jake, I know you spent a lot of time getting to join us, but John Williams of Shadow Stats is going to be joining us. And we've referred to Shadow Stats a lot here on the program, Jake, and quoted them extensively in terms of what goes on with the inflation rate and unemployment and so forth. But this is going to be an opportunity, don't you think, to actually hear from the horse's mouth what's really been going on with those things.
Oh, fantastic one. And John Williams recently put out a hyperinflation report, which I plan to grill him on a little bit. And it's his website, again, shadowstats.com, offers some fantastic services in that it's pretty much an alternative method of news other than the government reports. And what John Williams has done and what we've referred to multiple times is how the government manipulates the inflation numbers, how it manipulates employment numbers, and he's really kind of the expert on how it's all done.
Absolutely so. And I guess I want to kind of reverse the order of what I touched on in the teaser leading into the break there. I want to touch first on what happened with the creator of an alternative currency named Bernard von Nothausen. And Jake, maybe you can give us the details. What happened when he was brought to trial and the results of that trial this past week?
Right. Bernard von Nothausen, aged 67, was brought to a federal court. And his crime that he was charged with was selling coins that were labeled as, quote, Liberty Dollars, unquote, that was minted with some similarities to government money. It said dollars on it. It said Liberty. And at some point, his employees and himself had tried to pass these off actually as currency, as dollars in exchange. Also, I think it's also worth mentioning that his website consistently referred to a group called NORFED, I believe, which is a group that wanted to abolish the Federal Reserve, which is something that we talk about on the show all the time. It's just not typically done by someone who's minting coins or collectibles. But the New York Sun, which is the print version of the New York Sun, is obsolete, but they still have an online journal. And they wrote an editorial called A Unique Form of Terrorism, because the the judge said that Mr. Von Nothaus was guilty of financial terrorism.
Actually, it was the attorney, the prosecuting attorney.
Oh, yeah, sorry, you are correct. And the editorial, I'll read just the first paragraph from it. Here is a thought experiment concerning two men who have issued money. One issued gold and silver coins that will today bring in more dollars than he charged for them. The other issued paper notes that are worth but a fraction the gold and silver they were worth at the time they were issued. One man is facing the possibility of years in prison after a federal jury found his issuing of money to have been a crime. The other man is walking around free and being treated by authorities with great difference. Which is which? And obviously, the person that we just talked about is the one that made those coins, and if you would have bought them, you'd be able to exchange them for multiples of what they were initially sold for. And the other fellow is Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who has overseen a plummet in the purchasing power of the dollar compared to gold, silver, oil, kind of you name it. He's been taking care of it. And it's, you know, in a lot of ways, it's pretty sad, you know, the way this whole thing went down. I have to comment that if you read the laws and are aware of the coinage laws and the specific things that Mr. Von Nothaus was doing, it's kind of without a shadow of a doubt that he did violate the law. However, you know, the jury would have been the ones that could have decided whether or not it was really a crime worth imprisoning someone for, or if he was doing something else. So it's kind of a lamentable occurrence, but...
Well, it's more than lamentable. I think it's actually worse than that. I mean,
oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, and, you know, there's other folks, like, for instance, on our show, we had on Karen Emery last year at some point, and she also mints silver coins and sells them, but some of the key differences is she's always very specific to mention that, and I believe her website is like delvalleysilver.com, just for an example. But what they do is, you know, there's no, the coins do not say dollar, they do not say liberty, they're just marked with the weight of silver. And there is still a legal way to trade silver or whatever you really want using, you have to do it completely legally as a merchant, as a consumer. You need to file IRS forms.
This is as a collectible rather than as a coin? Is that the idea?
Well, that's the idea, but you can also trade it. And she's working at, she has a very small merchant network, mainly locally where she's living at. But the fact of the matter is you can comply with the legal laws in the United States and still mint the coins. It's just, you know, the way that you go about it. And, for instance, what Mr. Von Nothaus was doing very plainly was meant to agitate it, and that might have been his intent. But the end result is the federal agents have swooped in. They have removed... I'm trying to look for the amount, but they've confiscated his entire inventory, and a lot of people actually have placed orders that were never filled. And
I believe it was around 16,000 pounds of inventory.
Wow. Right. I'm trying to get a dollar because of a dollar number on it, but it's fairly substantial amount.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's kind of theft. You could argue it's the government doing that, because obviously, Von Nothaus could have said, you know, I'll not distribute these coins, or I'll melt them down or return the people's money. But
what about their money, all the people have invested?
Yeah, at age 67, he is most likely heading off to a federal prison, and that is a very sad thing in our country.
But as you pointed out, the most disturbing part about this whole thing is that the U.S. attorney in charge, her name is Ann Tompkins, made a statement immediately after the trial that referred to terrorism. Here's the exact statement that she made. She said, attempts to undermine the legitimate currency of this country are simply a unique form of domestic terrorism. While these forms of anti-government activities do not involve violence, they are every bit as insidious and represent a clear and present danger to the economic stability of this country.
Clear and present danger.
So in other words, from her point of view, the real question of the trial wasn't whether the NORFED coins were intended to be counterfeits of the U.S. dollar. The real question, in her view, was whether those who advocate the use of these coins, these gold and silver coins as money, should be considered terrorists.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's really the opposite. Like the true, and I'm using this term loosely, the true financial terrorists, as it were, it's really the Federal Reserve. They're
absolutely
the ones that are they are the ones that are diluting and debauching and devaluing the currency by printing up all these dollars. They're the ones violating the Constitution of the United States. And for Ann Tompkins to say something like this, one would hope she's completely illiterate with the history of money, but second of all, it's, you know, just trying to, the language that's used there is clear and present danger to the economic stability. Like, that's a complete lie. And to, you know, to call him a domestic terrorist is extremely is extremely incorrect.
Well, plus,
and
look what they convicted him of. They convicted him of counterfeiting. Now, the whole idea of counterfeiting, if you look at the word counterfeit in the dictionary, what you'll see is counterfeiting is replacing something with something else of much lesser value, an imitation, a bad fake, a fake that basically cheats somebody else out of value. In this case, what von Nothaus was creating was something that actually had greater value than the currency that he was purporting to compete with.
Which is the actual problem.
So the question becomes, is that counterfeiting? And
no,
I don't see how you can say that
problem.
That's counterfeiting.
It is the problem, of course, you know, as far as the government goes. So it's not,
the, I mean,
no,
the,
it's not
the way the government structures the laws, and Jake is right about this, the way they've written the laws, it does satisfy the law.
Right.
But does it satisfy the concept? I don't think it satisfies the concept at all. I think it actually rubs the concept in your face. And
oh,
says,
yeah.
Here, take this with your counterfeit concept and, you know, just throw it out the window because it doesn't matter anymore. Counterfeit is whatever we say it is.
Yeah. We do it, and it's not what we do. It's what you do.
That's right.
Yeah,
we have a right to debate.
We have a right to do it.
I would be interested to take a closer look at the case, too, because, you know, I would like to see exactly where, you know, this obviously – the idea that most people have of counterfeiting is somebody, you know, mints up the coins or prints up the dollars and starts using them in circulation, like the actual Federal Reserve notes.
Yeah,
but,
imitation, an imitation, right?
Right, right. And for there to be a, and again, we don't really follow English common law anymore, but what our country was founded on is you'd have to have parties that would issue a complaint. So if you're going to have, like, a private mintage of something like that, it would be the users of the coins or the people that he sold these coins to that would bring such a lawsuit against it, or the merchant that received the coins. But all too often what we see is, you know, just a bureaucrat, really, which is all Ann Tompkins really is, you know, charging a citizen with these crimes and locking them away for so long.
And you think about it, the coins that von Nothaus issued, for instance, he would issue a what he called a $5 silver coin. It was a 100% silver coin with a denomination of $5 on it. But the weight of that $5 silver coin made it worth much, much more than $5. So if for instance, let's say we had Ann Tompkins in front of us, and we put a $5 bill in front of her and a $5 von Nothaus coin in front of her, which one would she take?
And what? Well, did he sell them for $5, or did he sell them for...
He didn't sell them for $5. He sold them for more than $5.
But he called them $5.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so which is it?
Yeah, that's also what the U.S. Mint does. Like, the American Silver Eagles have a denomination of $1 on them. And
uh-huh.
Last time I checked silver, it was somewhere north of $37. I think it actually set another 31-year high in nominal dollar terms by going over $38 per ounce today.
The silver and gold talk about $50, something like that?
Yeah, gold also hit an all-time intraday high of, again, in nominal dollars at, I believe, $1,449 an ounce just today. And if you go back to when the started, when Mr. von Nothaus started doing all these coins and really, like the start of President Bush's term, like an ounce of gold was $265, and an ounce of silver was somewhere around $4 ish.
Four or five, yeah, somewhere
yeah,
in that range.
So it's kind
well,
of.
It seems kind of like what is the problem if he's actually, you know, he says they're $5, but he's actually selling them for their actual precious metal value. It seems like he's selling a collectible, not a coin.
Well, he also made very strong references on his website to how this was a way of resisting and replacing, in some ways, the current monopoly money supply.
So that was the problem.
That's what motivated the Feds to get involved, I'm sure.
Because it seems, you know, he was just taking the place of, or acting as a coin dealer until, you know.
But it raises a concern in my mind, because if they can go after him for trying to advocate replacing the money supply, what does that say about free speech?
Well, they're actually, like, from what you said, they're going after what he said rather than what he's doing.
Well, exactly. And that's the point. You're not allowed to go after somebody for what they say unless they actually harmed you, like through a, you know, a libel or something like that.
Yeah, right.
But there's no allegation of that. I mean, it almost sounds like it's a speech issue to me.
Yeah,
and I'm sure
right.
that Mr. Von Nauhaus would be pleased to anybody that bought coins with him in the last decade that could return their coins to get their dollars back.
Yeah, get the dollars. Here's your dollars.
Wait, I was recalling what happened. I know he was arrested in November 2008, and immediately after he was arrested, people who owned the Liberty Dollar coins were selling them on eBay. And I recall that, for instance, the gold coins, at that point gold was selling somewhere in the neighborhood of like $500, $600, $700 an ounce, something like that. And the gold coins, which were less than 1 ounce in total weight, were selling in the thousands of dollars.
Well, so they had become collectible then.
They had become collectible. In fact, they were so collectible because people figured, well, they're not going to be making any more coins, so these are going to become really valuable.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Oh, good grief.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's what he was doing had nothing to do with why he's in jail.
Yeah, this was they found a law that they could hang him on, and so they did, but the law really had nothing to do with why they were going after him. That, I think, is the one overwhelming story we can take away from this, no doubt about it. Let's go on to what's happening with on the inflation front. We continue to hear inflation is low in this country, despite the fact that the gas prices keep going up and the food prices keep going up, and virtually everything keeps going up. But the CPI doesn't see it that way. And an interesting piece of information came out of the UK over the past week. Jake, why don't you give us the details on that?
Right. The UK Telegraph has put out a couple articles specifically on England, and one article headlines that UK households are facing the biggest income fall since the 1970s as inflation bites, and that the average household's real income, what's coming in after inflation is taken into account, will have fallen by 1.6% over the past 3 years to the end of 2011. In contrast, over the previous half a century, real incomes rose at an average of 1.6% a year, or 5% every three-year period. So really what this is doing is just pointing out that the entire population of England as a whole is getting more and more poor. They're getting poorer and poorer. And the inflation rate, they just had a shock. The last month's reports came in from February. And the inflation is, this is the inflation rate, kind of like the UK CPI that is reported by the central bank, has jumped to a shocking 28-month high of 4.4%. And public borrowing recorded its worst February. I'm trying to get to the details on their target is 2%. In January had been 4%, and really the numbers that came in at 4.2% is really looking like it was much higher than the estimates have been. And then also they have another statistic that they use over in the UK called the retail price inflation, which is based on a longer-running index, and it uses a starting point from any wage negotiations. That rose to 5.5%, which is its highest since 1991. Just an example, and you can really kind of go anywhere on the planet these days and see where inflation is kind of taking hold.
And my take, I mean, you tell me if you think differently, but my take is that it's very likely that the inflation rates coming out of the UK are, in a sense, no different from those coming out of the United States, in that they're probably understated. Because, again, the central bankers, and you mentioned in this case it is a central bank in Britain who is issuing this information, they have a vested interest in making it look like inflation is not high. I mean, would you agree that these rates are probably, even in the 4 to 5% range, they're probably understated?
Yeah, most likely. And I think that we also have to keep in mind, really also worldwide, is that while we have a lot of these prices increasing, the one bubble, which was we talked about a little bit earlier on the show and consistently throughout the show, is that of mortgage prices. And what's interesting news coming in the United States is that monthly home sales, seasonally adjusted, have hit yet another all-time low since records began in January of 1963.
It's amazing that they can go down.
A new high and low.
Yeah, and you really have to kind of take a chart to see things. But
or a magnifying glass.
The previous lows, and again, this is when the population of the U.S. was extremely smaller back in the 60s and 70s, was around 400,000 homes sold per month. In February, the amount was 250,000. So
wow.
That's nationwide, 250,000. And in July of 2005, when the monthly home sales hit their maximum, it was 1.4 million. So it's really starting to get down to
new homes,
I guess, the 15-20% range of that market high. And median sales prices fell by 14%. Which also represents the sharpest one-month drop on record.
Wow.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
And these are these figures for new homes, is that right?
These are monthly home sales of all residential homes.
Wow, that's
so incredible. Yeah, well, if you want to look at new, you can also take, for the new homes, you can take a look at what the government tracks for those is the permits that are issued,
yeah.
And those permits are also at an all-time low. So it's really not a good time to be buying a home or trying to build a new one.
Or getting a real estate license.
Yeah, but
yeah,
and trying to get the copper wiring and everything for it in pipes is also not such a great idea.
And yet the prices continue to rise all over the place. Prices of gas rising. Electric vehicles are becoming more and more popular. And Gene, I know you have some details about that. Why don't you tell us what's going on with the electric vehicle industry?
Yeah, there's a resurgence, and it is a resurgence. We don't think about this, but electric vehicles actually go way back, and they were kind of at the forefront of the development of the automobile when there was more of a semblance of a free market, and they were competing with the gas automobile. But this article I'll read here, it says, electric wagons powered by heavy batteries quietly zip through streets of East Coast cities carrying beer, milk, fruit, and other goods. From wholesalers to shops and homes, some delivery companies installed their own charging stations or used a downtown garage maintained by the local utility to charge their wagons. This was in 1911.
Wow.
This is incredible here. Electric vehicles would grow to account for about one quarter of the automobiles in the United States by the 1920s. And now we have the new generation of electric cars with the Chevrolet Volt, the Nissan Leaf, and the Ford Focus. And I think in the next few years, 25 electric vehicle models that can be charged by plugging into a regular outlet are expected to be on the market. But it's kind of interesting. It goes on to say in the early 1900s, electric vehicles were on the streets of New York, Chicago, Boston, and Baltimore, and they were for a time favored because they were cleaner and easier to operate than the gasoline engines of the times. But this is funny because this is something that I didn't think of. But the demise of those early electric vehicles began when Cadillac introduced the electric starter for gasoline-powered cars in 1912. So it's kind of interesting. It was an electric motor that, you know, defeated the electric car.
Oh, dear.
Because, you know, before all those pictures where they would stand out in front of them, crank the big crank, I mean, that had to be a terrible task. You know, you can think of your lawnmower when it's not running good and how frustrating that is.
I have to admit, you surprised me because I thought we were going to be talking about modern electric cars. You took us back 100 years ago.
Yeah, and they do mention some stuff about the newer cars. It says it wasn't until the 60s and 70s with the rise of the environmental movement and the first significant gasoline price hikes that researchers began experimenting with electric vehicle technology again. But this is interesting. In the 1990s, General Motors produced an electric car, the EVI, whose lead-acid battery weighed 1,000 pounds. The new one, the Chevrolet Volt, uses a lithium-ion battery that weighs 400 pounds, and they think they're going to get even lighter. But many consumers think they're still too pricey, as the Volt is selling for $41,000, and the Nissan Leaf retails for about $33,000. But they do think prices are expected to drop. There's going to be increases in manufacturing, and battery costs are expected. This is as battery costs are alone are expected to plummet 70% in 2 to 3 years. And it's amazing how much those batteries cost. Like, I've heard that for the Insight, the hybrid vehicle, the battery alone is $4,000.
Mm. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
And, of course, it's hard to tell whether the price is actually going to come down depending on how quickly the inflation kicks in, but it's good to hear that the overall cost is coming down, because that's going to be important. With so many bad things happening, we need some good news like that.
Another interesting thing about electric cars is, it's surprising, but they refer to the motor in electric cars by their diameter. The motor for the Insight is 7 inches in diameter. That's the size of it. I mean, that's, the size. It's like a large table saw motor. But they're so efficient. Electric motors are 90-some percent efficient. So.
Yeah, that's true, and that's what certainly makes the whole thing work better than anybody might expect. Of course, what's not been working very well is the budgetary process on Capitol Hill, as the Democrats and Republicans still are vying to see who can win the game of chicken. And among other things, this has apparently pissed off some people among the right wing. Jake, why don't you give us the details on that?
Right. Again, the Tea Party group miffed at the GOP. The Republicans has planned a Capitol protest in Washington, D.C., that they're calling a continuing revolution rally. They are underscoring their disappointment with the House Republicans over Washington's ongoing budget battles. On their website, and the group TeaPartyPatriots.org is kind of an umbrella group of many, some of them 912 groups, some of them just Tea Party groups, some of them just concerned citizen groups, to kind of bind all these groups together. They've also been a major part of past rallies in Washington, D.C., and what they've stated is that everything that they're doing in Congress right now is completely ludicrous. They were sent to D.C. to cut spending, and while they may say that they're cutting $10 billion from the budget in a three-week period, the same day an additional $72 billion was added to the deficit. I think that what we mentioned with Libya is just another example of fiscal irresponsibility. But the House Republicans pledged that they were going to cut $100 billion in spending this fiscal year. So far, it kind of went down to $60 billion and is kind of moving around down there yet. They haven't followed through on even suggesting the bill, because, again, the House is controlled by the Republicans. It's possible the Senate would vote it down. Which is actually what John Boehner is stating, like, we won't do this because they'll just move it down. But that's the whole thing, is that they have the power to actually suggest the legislation. If it doesn't get through the Senate, at least it gets out into the public discussion. And the Republicans are really just kind of revealing themselves as a group to not be fiscally conservative. And it's kind of, in my mind, good to see this Tea Party group viewing it that they have had some gain of ground in the past couple of years, but they see that really nothing's happening, and they're staying to the course. And by calling it a continuing revolution rally, I think that's a pretty good step in the right direction, and hopefully they'll start to realize, and from my conversations here locally with many, they already do realize that that the Republicans are just the Democrats, and the Democrats are just the Republicans when you boil everything down to it.
Pretty much what it comes down to, absolutely. Well, fortunately, we're near the end of the hour here, and I just want to do a quick wrap-up. One thing that Gene was going to touch on, we'll have to do it next week, but today is the anniversary of the passage of the health care package last year, and that's had some interesting ramifications. So, Gene, if you'll bring us up to date next week, that would be great. And we'll ask you all to join us next week on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Stay free.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution.